Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1001. Further reflections on weaponized feminism and the hashtag MeToo movement. This is being recorded on March 20th of the year 2018. I was going to delve into the topic of weaponized feminism more deeply, or do a deeper dive, I guess you could say, than I am going to be doing here. There is so much else going on that I want to get to that. This program will be something of a transition, a bridge, if you will, to the topic of school shootings and fascist groups. We're going to delve back in the archives, as I will explain, but along the lines of one of the things I don't think has been properly explored, and that is a manifestation of what I have called in the past the four B's of American politics: bribes, bullets, beds, and blackmail. And an example of that surfaced in a big way. This story has received coverage around the world in connection with Cambridge Analytica, the data processing firm that was very close to the Mercers and to the Trump campaign, and that we spoke about at great length in, among other programs, For the Record 946. Channel 4 News in Britain on March 19th of 2018 had the following story revealed: Trump's election consultants filmed saying they used bribes and sex workers to entrap politicians, unquote. Senior executives at Cambridge Analytica, the data company that credits itself with Donald Trump's presidential victory, have been secretly filmed saying they could entrap politicians in compromising situations with bribes and Ukrainian sex workers. Skipping down. In one exchange, when asked about digging up material on political opponents, Mr. Nix said they could, quote, send some girls around to the candidate's house, unquote, adding that Ukrainian girls, quote, are very beautiful. I find that works very well, unquote. This is an example of what I think needs more examination in connection with the hashtag MeToo movement, etc. Obviously, I do not hold a brief for sexual harassment. One of the things that makes this so relativistic, I guess you could say, is that generally sexual harassment occurs in private. It remains one person's word against another's. That is one of the reasons I find the bloodless political assassination of Al Franken, in part done by anonymous accusers, momentum coming from a manifestation of technocratic fascism, an army of Japanese, well-financed Japanese Twitter bots lent momentum to Al Franken's removal. And frankly, the gag photograph of Al Franken supposedly groping Leanne Tweeden's breasts through a flak jacket. It was an obviously staged photo, obviously a gag photo, and that no more represents sexual harassment than the photo of Leanne Tweeden grabbing the butt of a male performer on stage at the same USO tour constitutes sexual harassment. One could question the taste involved, and yet obviously the post-adolescent body or libidinous aesthetic of a USO tour is going to be like that. Servicemen, most of whom are in their 20s, some of whom younger, attending a USO show in a theater of war, aren't expecting a recital of Gregorian chants. That sexuality and sexual charges can be used as a vehicle for political destruction is self-evident in what Alexander Nix talked about here. The fact that they were talking about using, quote, Ukrainian sex workers or girls, unquote, I think is also interesting and possibly significant, with Ukraine being a major arena of fascist political activity at this point in time. And again, I'm not suggesting that all or even most of the examples are setups, but some of them clearly appear to be. And the bloodless political assassination of Al Franken and the neutralization of the political will of the people of Minnesota deserves greater scrutiny than it has received. So, too, the removal of John Conyers, one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus, one of the few congressional critics of the Nazi Azov Battalion in Ukraine. I noted in our last program that for more than 20 years, his administrative assistant, someone who did not complain about his sexual behavior, was none other than civil rights movement icon Rosa Parks. I did not know an aspect of her political resume that I am going to relate now. From the History.com blog of December 8th of 2017, by Ryan Matamore, M-A-T-T-I-M-O-R-E. Before the bus, Rosa Parks was a sexual assault investigator. 2017 may well become known as the year of hashtag MeToo, but the women standing up today are in fact part of a long history of activists fighting sexual harassment. And one of the activists more commonly associated with another movement was a key figure in the early attempts to rectify sexual injustice, Rosa Parks. Revered as a civil rights icon, Rosa Parks is best known for sparking the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott, but her activism in the black community predates that day. She joined the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in 1943, 12 years before that fateful commute. In her first years in the organization, she worked specifically on criminal justice and its application in Alabama communities. One part of this was protecting black men from false accusations and lynchings. The fact that John Conyers would have employed her as his administrative assistant for more than two decades would in and of itself have made him a target, and I wonder if Rosa Parks were alive today, what she might have to say about his removal. Basically a political lynching, in my opinion, that was signaled much as Roger Stone signaled the removal of Al Franken. Mike Cernovich, that's Mike, "Misogyny gets you laid," Cernovich, an actual quote, signaled the removal of John Conyers, a political lynching, in my opinion. With regard to weaponized feminism, that has been something, that is something that has been around for a long time. I'm going to publish and post a link to a transcript of an archive show that I did back in 1996, Gloria in Excelsis. This is about the well-documented relationship between Gloria Steinem, arguably America's most iconic feminist, and the CIA, in interviews that she gave to both the Washington Post and the New York Times in 1967. She maintained that she had worked for the CIA and that she found it to be good journalistic training. She has alleged that she severed her contact with the agency after that. There are a number of things that I think suggest that, in fact, her relationship with the agency continued long after that and was, in fact, inextricably linked with the acceleration of her professional career. Her professional growth was greatly aided by the Graham Publishing Empire, which has long-standing links with the CIA. Her paramour of 9 years, J. Stanley Pottinger, was a close personal friend of George H.W. Bush, the man for whom CIA headquarters is named, and who also was the attorney for the Hashemi brothers in the Iran-Contra, or the October surprise gambit, and who also, according to Donald Freed and Fred Landis in the book Death in Washington, was the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights under Nixon and Ford, who helped block the, I guess this would have been under Gerald Ford, who helped block the investigation into the assassinations of both Martin Luther King and Salvador Allende. I'm going to publish a transcript for that miscellaneous archive show, which was recorded live on the air, and the recording levels for which are much too high, I think, for rebroadcast. So I'm going to put a link to the Gloria Steinem archive show in the description for the program. Now, in August of 1996, I did an interview with the late Frank Spiering, or Spiering, S-P-I-E-R-I-N-G, the author of Who Killed Polly. This is a discussion of the Polly Klaas case, the kidnapping and murder of Polly Klaas. There appears to be much more to that case than meets the eye. Polly appears to have been the victim of a powerful conspiracy, very possibly an international conspiracy, and we'll talk more about that later. Here is an excerpt from For the Record program number 7.
Something has undermined the confidence of children growing up as children, whether it's the lack of faith in their parents, the fact that we become such a materialistic society that children no longer feel the bond of love holding them. You know, in Joe Klaas, Polly's grandfather, said in Russia when he was there in the department stores, the parents hold their children's hands. You go to a mall here and you see children running around. They don't know where their parents are.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all alone. I saw a little girl the other day walking up a highway. She's about 12 years old, about Polly Klaas's age, beautiful little blonde girl, all alone. And I thought, my goodness, some camper could just pull over and pull her in and she's gone forever. We're losing 1,000 little girls a year, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, who are being abducted and being sold.
And we're going to get into what may have happened to Polly in the issue of the fact that there are more Polly Klaases out there in the second part of the interview, Frank. What I want to note in passing is the point that you've made very effectively, namely that this case and others like it have had a profound effect on the psyche of Americans. You have children and parents who are terrified, and that is in and of itself a profound political situation. When you have a terrified population, you have a population which may be in a position to surrender many of its civil liberties and democratic principles in order to allay those fears.
Exactly.
Getting to the circumstances, and again, we're limited for time here, Frank, and you've set forth so much information that I think is necessary to be gone over that I want to start getting into the actual circumstances.
Sure.
Of the kidnapping and probable murder or possible murder of Polly Klaas, because there are a great many questions. And indeed, as much as people have heard about this case, you have made a great many points that have not received the attention due them. Let's start with the kidnapping itself,
all right,
Frank.
Well, in my book, Who Killed Polly, of course, it really delineates that whole night where she was alone in her bedroom with her two little friends. And they were preparing costumes for Halloween. Suddenly this man appears at her door in her bedroom upstairs.
What night was this exactly? This was the date of what?
October 1st, 1993.
Okay.
And she's up there with her two little friends, and they're having a good time, and these are 12-year-old girls. This man appears at the door with a knife. He's a bearded man, and he says first of all, he says, who lives here? Polly says she does. He takes her. He binds the other two little girls. That's a very important, who lives here. And second, he says, I'm only doing this for the money. She says, well, I'll give you some money. And she offers him $50 from her jewel box. He doesn't take it. Then the next thing that happens, and this was, both of the other little girls testified to this under oath at both the pre-trial hearing and also the trial. He became furious when Polly said, please, don't wake up my mother. She's in the next room sleeping, which she was. And he said, the perpetrator said, There aren't supposed to be any parents in the house. The use of the word parents. And she became furious. She said, you're lying. And it became almost violently furious. And she said, no, my mother's sleeping. My mother's sleeping in the next room. He took Polly off with him. And that was the last that anyone ever saw her again that we know of.
Let's stop right there for a sec, Frank. Now, there are several things of note here. First of all, Richard Allen Davis says, I'm only doing this for the money.
Yes.
There doesn't seem to be any doubt that he, in fact, abducted Polly Klaas. And indeed, we're going to get into the curious aspects of his confession later.
Yeah.
But according to the case as it's been presented to us, a case of abduction, rape, and murder, the question, of course, has to be raised. Why? And we're going to answer this in the second part of the interview. Why would Richard Allen Davis be doing this for money? Who's he going to get the money from?
Yeah, well, that's the point, you see. And that's what I ask in my book. That's my major question, is who hired Richard Allen Davis?
And indeed, if he's doing this for money, why wouldn't he have taken the money offered him by Polly?
Yeah, well, that would seem certainly logical.
And
Except,
the fascinating case is, if this was just some brute and pervert who was out to abduct and rape and murder a child, why would it have mattered which child lived in the house?
That's exactly true. Davis, see, I have talked in great detail to his sister and his brother-in-law. He has a strange kind of ethical background that comes from prison, primarily, this whole kind of thing they go for.
And he is a habitual, he's been in and out of prisons much of his adult life.
At the time that Polly was abducted, he had just been put on parole for serving 8 years in a kidnapping case, and he'd just been let out 2.5 months before. So he was living at a men's residence in San Mateo. And for some reason, he comes all the way up to Petaluma, a town he'd never been in before, really, and goes into a bedroom he'd never been in, and takes this little girl. And, of course, the question I have is, well, someone sent him up there, because obviously he was primarily a burglar, not really a person that kidnapped or killed people. And he was always after the money. That's the whole story of his life as a convict. But the thing is that Davis himself was not a very smart man, but he had this code of ethics. And one of them was, and he told his sister this, that he did not snitch. In other words, he would never convey who it was that hired him. The other thing was, and this is important, he had this kind of special thing about children. The closest people in his life are the two children that are the kids of his sister. In other words, he feels very responsible for them, which is another reason the sister feels that he will not divulge the names of those people that hired him. He did call the next morning his brother-in-law and said that he had been in the area that night and that people were supposed to give him money, but they hadn't come through with the money, which, of course, leads us to the next part of the story.
We should not fail to note that he had apparently been given intelligence about that house on that night, namely that the parents were not supposed to be home. And indeed, you mentioned that Polly's mother was home only because of some sort of alteration in her work schedule.
That's right. They were supposed to put in a telephone system in her office, and they did this, and she went home. She was supposed to be at the office that night.
Now, you mentioned right after Richard Allen Davis had been released from prison, shortly before he committed this crime, you mentioned that the circumstances surrounding his existence suggest that he had money coming from someplace. He was able to buy a car, was he not?
Yes. Well, apparently he had a few part-time jobs he was able to get, but he was not certainly going to have got the money he needed to buy a car, even to have a car registered in California. Costs $100, which doesn't seem like much, but for a fellow who has no money at all and who has to, you know, live and so forth and travel gasoline and all that, to go all the way up to Petaluma for no other reason than just to go there and visit and come back, doesn't make sense.
And one point, again, that we should emphasize is that the sort of inmate's code of honor or criminal's code of honor, which one does not snitch on a fellow lawbreaker, appears to be one of the factors keeping Richard Allen Davis silent about whoever it was that he appears to have been in league
with. Exactly, because you see, the big thing is that night, and this is where law enforcement comes into this picture.
We're going to be dealing in just a couple of minutes with the curious behavior of various law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
But I think it's real important that remember 10:30 at night was the time he appeared in Polly's room. When Polly's mother awakened 15 minutes later because the children finally screamed out, she called the police, called 911, and they were supposed to send out an APB, right?
Mm-hmm.
They did not do it. Later on, the sheriff lied about it in Sonoma County, saying that it had been sent out on the wrong channel. And then months later, he admitted it had never been sent out at all. But no reason was ever given why an APB describing this perpetrator had not been sent out.
We're very important.
We're going to go back
to that very important point in just a minute. Before we, in a sense, leave the scene of the crime on that night, there are a couple of interesting points that I'd like to touch on. You mentioned in your book, Frank, that there was an account of a clean-shaven stranger, either conducting reconnaissance or looking, and yet Richard Allen
Someone
Davis had a beard.
The neighbor in the back saw a clean-shaven man on the porch of Polly's house, looking through the window. Who that person was to this day, we don't know. But we do know this, that no one in the neighborhood ever saw Richard Allen Davis's car. And believe me, this was a white Pinto that would have been easily spotted. We're talking about a little neighborhood where everybody knows everybody's business. I mean, I've been through that neighborhood, and believe me, the little houses next door to each other, if you pulled up there for any length of time, someone would have seen this car. No one saw it, but they did see a gray Honda, which no one knows where that car is. The next thing we know is...
This gray Honda was at the scene of the crime?
Yes. Someone spotted a gray Honda parked nearby.
Has there been any discussion of that gray Honda
since
the crime?
Never came up in the trial. See, so much of this information has not come up in the courtroom. And it's been limited by what the judge wants to put in and what the attorneys have agreed to put into the case. When I challenged the judge immediately on the first day of the trial, and I did, Judge Hastings, I appeared in court asking for TV cameras, you know, to be put into the courtroom,
because
I thought it was essential. He had me thrown out of the courtroom, and I had submitted a whole brief and everything else. I'd done it all legally, and he stated, he pounded the desk twice, and he told all the reporters and everybody, quote, "The purpose of this court is not to educate anyone." He said it twice. Now, he's done very, very well, Judge Hastings, because we don't even know what the motive is, according to the case that he has there in the courtroom. They don't even have a motive. I mean, all they have is this man who admitted doing it, and we don't even know why he admitted doing it. So the thing is that every step along the way, the pretrial hearings were closed to the public, and even the family of Polly Klass. Joe Klass said to me, "What are they hiding, Frank?" Every step along the way, they've hidden, and this is really what this part of the story is, because you see, the facts of this case, they're hiding from the public.
We're going to be getting into the institutional behavior, Frank, of the various law enforcement and judicial agencies that are in charge with handling the case as the interview develops. But one of the things that I wanted to go into, we've been talking about some of the anomalies in the investigation vis-a-vis the actual crime scene. Davis's curious statements about nobody was supposed to be here.
Yes.
He's only doing it for the money. Which one of you lives here? The reports of a clean-shaven stranger. And Richard Allen Davis wore a beard. The reports of a gray Honda. Now, before Richard Allen Davis was brought to justice, in a sense, he was, in fact, stopped by law enforcement in the area of the crime within a very short period of time.
One hour later, along a deserted road, which is approximately 15 miles off Highway 101, which is a major highway in Northern California, in a wilderness kind of a state area, owned by a lady named Dana Jaffe. Dana Jaffe's babysitter was coming down the hill in her car. Suddenly she was terrorized by this man coming out of the woods, pounding on her door and her windows. She took off. She called the police. Sheriff's deputies showed up. Now, this is an hour after the abduction. They find the white Pinto that Davis owned in a ditch. It stalled in a ditch, supposedly. And Davis is standing there near it, drinking a can of beer. He's got more beer in the Pinto. They ask him what he's doing there. Now it's 12:30 at night, 1 o'clock. It was 12:30 at night, 12 at night.
He's drinking beer in front of these police.
That's right. And
he's in a car.
That's right. And he says, "Well, throw, get rid of that." So he says, "Okay." So he throws the can in the bushes. They say, you can't do that, so he picks up the can. At any rate, then they say, what are you doing here? He said, I'm sightseeing.
Now, and do I remember correctly that he also, at that time, also said he'd been taking drugs or smoking dope?
No, that didn't come up then.
No, that didn't come up then. Okay, I was...
No, that's later on in the confession.
Okay, but we should remember that within an hour of Polly's abduction, Davis is stopped in the area by police. He's in his car, he's drinking beer.
Yep.
And yet, this does not apparently elicit a great deal of curiosity.
Well, then what happened was the sheriff's deputies maintained... They called, and they found out there were no warrants out on Davis. Well, you see, the thing is, under law, there doesn't have to be a warrant. If a person's on parole, right, a felon, it's a red flag that goes up in the computer system, the IC computer system. They would have known automatically to bring him in for being in and about. In other words, he was breaking the law. And the thing is, they would have dragged him right in. But they maintained, they found out nothing about this man, and neither did anybody back in the dispatcher's office. And yet, an hour before, they had been given an APB describing this guy and hadn't sent it out. It's beginning to look rather fishy.
Now, again, this guy's, he's in a car, he's drinking beer.
That's right.
Which is not something I would recommend.
And they let him go in 37 minutes. In fact, they're kind enough, these officers, to actually help him out of the ditch. They get a chain and they pull him out. And they let him go on his way. And they just say, you know, just get home safe.
Now, this after an APB had been put out for an individual who had abducted Polly Klass.
That's correct.
And we should bear in mind that this guy was supposedly sightseeing on a private road after midnight, drunk in a car.
Right.
And he was a paroled felon.
That's correct.
With a history of crimes of the general type.
And it just terrified the babysitter. You know, I would I would not want a man like that loose in my front yard, would you?
No, and he just terrified the babysitter, and beyond that, he had a track record of abduction and sexual violence against women.
Exactly. Now, they did not find Polly, and that's important. They checked the trunk of the car, they checked everything, and they couldn't find her. He takes off, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is, remember the gray Honda? Remember the white Pinto?
Mm-hmm.
There was an exchange there, I believe, where Davis had already turned Polly over to the people who had hired him.
So, in other words, when he was stopped, according to the official version, or at least according to Davis's confession, we're going to get to that in just a minute, Polly was stashed
up on
some bushes?
She was in the bushes, yeah.
And was she gagged?
No. She was sitting there, and she was not gagged, he says.
You mentioned in your book that her parents maintained that Polly, due to her training and personality, was not likely to have simply sat docilely by while this trance took place.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
She was a very active woman, had also taken some martial arts, had she not?
Yes, her her grandfather, Joe, had done trained her some martial arts. She was somebody who would not have sat there, believe me.
And she was in a position to yell if she wanted.
Oh, totally.
And yet, at least according to the official version, she did not.
Well, we're talking about a confession, which is a phony confession, I believe, taken by a sergeant from the Petaluma Police Department, who, when I confronted him, and I asked him, I said, you know, because we're talking about now, we're looking over a two-month period, when they maintained that they had no suspects, no clues, no way of locating this little girl. The FBI, 5 hours after Polly's abduction, had 14 agents arrive in Petaluma. 14, that's a lot of agents.
Mm-hmm.
And they had 50 agents there by the end of the week. They called the Petaluma Police Department.
And we're going to discuss the functioning of the FBI in connection with this case a little later.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, now after this, I think we could certainly call it a remarkable encounter on this private road just after the crime.
Yes.
And even before Richard Allen Davis was arrested and before his confession, which we're going to touch on in a minute, there was yet another noteworthy encounter between Richard Allen Davis and law enforcement, which still did not result in his immediate arrest, and that was when he was arrested for drunken driving.
Drunken driving by the California Highway Patrol, and they released him, too, very quickly. And once again, no one apparently said checked the computer, or said they didn't, and found that he was a felon on parole. Otherwise, he'd have gone right back to jail, because that's the way it works. And as far as his drug business is concerned, in the confession, he states, supposedly it's his confession, that he was drugged up and didn't know what he was doing and so forth. I talked to his parole officer, Ronald March, in San Mateo. He was spot-checked from that night forward for the next 2 months, actually 6 weeks. And there was never any sign that he'd ever had drugs. Otherwise, they would instantly, that's an infraction that puts him right back in prison when you're on parole. You can't take drugs. That's the way it works. And so basically, what is the motive? What was the reason why that he was in this situation? We don't have the little girl anymore. He stated, I'm doing this for the money. He went in there and said, who lives here? It becomes clearer and clearer there's something else going on. And this is the thing that's, I think, so important in this story. That's not just about one little girl. And my book, Who Killed Polly, is very clear about it. It's about what's happening all across this country. I have evidence that there's a whole underworld thing going on where these little children are disappearing. They're being sold. They're being sexually exploited. There are children. And we'll go into that, I know, later on, if you wanted to.
Indeed. Right? I think the hypothesizing concerning what may have happened to Polyclas is something that's important and, in a sense, is going to be the destination that we're going to arrive at after this fascinating, albeit very unpleasant, journey that you take a reader through in your book, Who Killed Polly? Now, again, in the confession that Richard Allen Davis offered, and this confession has been the centerpiece of the state's case against him, and again, I don't think anyone, including yourself, disputes that he actually did kidnap Polly. The question is, did he rape her, as he's alleged to have done? Did he murder her? In this confession, he maintains that he pulled this off alone, doesn't mention anything about anybody else being involved or a clean-shaven stranger, gray Honda, etc.
Right.
But his excuse for much of the fuzziness and some of the anomalies in his behavior, some of the strange aspects of his behavior, was that he was drunk and stoned, that he had he said he'd bought a joint from someone in the area, smoked it, and that he sort of went out and he sort of lost it at that point.
Well, when I asked Sergeant Meese, who took this confession, you know, who actually wrote it for Davis, Davis signed it, I said, where was he for 2 months, you know? where, I mean, you had him, he fit your VICAP survey, the FBI has, every element of it. That means, you know, the VICAP is a violent criminal apprehension program.
We're going to get into that later, yeah.
But the thing is, he says, Meese said to me, well, I know where he was, or I knew where he was. I said, what? He said, well, I mean, I know now where he was. He said, are you trying to say, he said, that I knew where he was the whole time? I said, I'm not saying anything. But it was quite clear, you know, that Meese, the way he reacted to the thing, the way they all do, they knew where he was, and they knew who he was. They knew his identity very quickly, and they let him be out there. They let him stay out there. And he was a very short distance away the whole time they were so-called looking for Polly and her abductor. Mark Klass said on December 3rd, 1993, 2 months later, he said, it's been my feeling for a long time that the man who took Polly was working with or for someone else.
And indeed, Joe Klass, her grandfather, stated in no uncertain terms that Polly's kidnapping was the work of a conspiracy.
Exactly.
Or was the product of a conspiracy.
And Mark actually told the New York Times, which was quoted in the Times, that he speculated that Davis must have snatched her and handed her off to an accomplice, since there was no sign of the child in his company when he was pulled from the ditch soon after the kidnapping.
The curious aspects of the forensics. Now, eventually, long after Richard Allen Davis was arrested and, quote, confessed, unquote, note the quotes, the body, ostensibly that of Polyclas, was discovered, and there are a lot of questions about that. Could you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, her body was discovered supposedly. Now, I say this all supposedly because this is only the reports we get from the FBI. No one has ever seen her body. In fact, the family of Polly Klass was never allowed to identify her body. No one's ever identified her body. Supposedly it was identified by the FBI laboratory in Washington, D.C., and that took 6 weeks because they had to have some special expert who was in Bosnia at the time fly in to identify it.
Why do you suppose that was done?
I think it was to stall for time. I don't think they knew exactly what to do. They were, see, basically what they had done was this. Davis had been left out there for 2 months, and he'd been left out there because they knew where he was. But this gave them an excuse to come up with what they would call a body. And this gave it time for the body, quote-unquote, to decompose. Where they found this so-called body was in a place called Cloverdale in Northern California. I've been there. Let me explain to you what it is. It's like a yard. It's a little field right off the main highway. This area is, there's people in and out of there all the time. There was a little girl who had been in there looking for different things, sticks and flowers. She maintained she'd been around a little creek area where they found the body on top of a, supposedly on top of a bush where it had been left. There are trucks in and out there doing construction work. This is a heavily populated area. Supposedly laid out there for 2 months, this body, and no one ever saw it, right? Now, the thing is that Davis, of course, the other part that I always kind of was amused by, one, a tipster, somebody by a tip, seeing a photograph or seeing this poster of a drawing, called the FBI and said, here's where you'll find this man. They never identified who it was that gave the tip, but they found Davis living with his sister and his brother-in-law on an Indian reservation in near Ukiah, California, which is fairly close to Cloverdale. Supposedly Davis took them to where the body was and admitted to them that he had done this. Now, this is a hardened criminal doing this. Suddenly he's very open admitting he did all this, and here's the body, and he was just very open with them. I have trouble believing that. But nonetheless, they so-called find the body. They maintain they identified it, and I was very, very questioning with the head of the FBI on this and also Sergeant Meese. They said the major thing they based it on was the dental. Now, the thing is that I've talked to a lot of dental experts, forensic experts. Children at that age, they have much better nutrition, of course, today, and hygienics. And the children don't have the cavities that they once had. I mean, unless you have a missing tooth, which Polly didn't have. And x-rays generally have a tendency to be somewhat blurred. So it's hard even to tell one child from another with just the normal situation. With Polly, all that was left supposedly was part of a jaw, which makes it, I would say, even more difficult to determine that this, in fact, was Polly Klass. They said the rest of it was just bones, and they couldn't really identify too much. This is why the family was told that they would not be allowed to see the body. They were given Polly's or whatever remains of whoever this was to the family. They were given a dust, supposedly remains had been cremated, which were spread over Monterey Bay later on in a funeral ceremony. We have a situation where the FBI from day one has controlled every bit of evidence. They were there 5 hours, as I said, after the abduction. 18 agents, actually 16 agents, and these agents literally controlled everything. And the APB was never sent out. They maintained later they found a handprint of Richard Allen Davis on Polly's bedroom door. Now, I don't know if you're aware of the expert at the O.J. case, who is the chemist, Frederick Whitehurst.
Mm-hmm.
And maintained that the FBI manufactures evidence for prosecutions and had done this in 150 cases.
We're going to get, by the way, he was not allowed to testify in that case.
That's
either.
That's correct.
We're going to get to the functioning of the FBI as an institution, and mm-hmm. I think there are some of the most important questions in this case, and perhaps a hint as to what sort of authority might have been involved in this act. It comes from the way the FBI was apparently bent to the will of the perpetrators. But going back to the actual forensics, now here we have a body that's discovered in Cloverdale
mm-hmm.
in a well-traveled area, and yet nobody had seen it before.
That's correct.
And this is again in
which
a case...
Which the perpetrator, the kidnapper, just leads them to and never thought about it, you know?
And this, again, is in an exceedingly high-profile case, and this is in an area that was well-traveled, and yet nobody had seen, or what is perhaps as relevant, nobody had smelled this decomposing body.
That's correct. And no one has ever to this day seen this body that we know of except the FBI.
And the body was supposedly identified from dental records, which is not a good way to identify a deceased child. Yet the lower jaw was missing.
Yeah.
Part of the skull was missing.
Yes.
The body was too decomposed to mm-hmm. be fingerprinted.
So they say.
Mm-hmm. And now we are also, one of the most fascinating details about this case concerns the fact that apparently the parents never saw the body. In other words, the parents of Polly Klass have never identified this body.
No, they've never seen it.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing is that there's a lot of situations, there's a lot of things here. Now we're getting into areas that get very disturbing. Why didn't they demand to identify the body?
Mm-hmm.
Why were they put off by law enforcement and by the FBI? Then the next question I have is, then why did the Klass family, Mark and Joe, change their story about there being someone else involved with Davis? That's totally forgotten today.
I certainly haven't. It has not had. It has not made any of the coverage on the case.
Not
and
at all.
A lot of it.
And there's been plenty of time for them to bring that issue up.
Now the autopsy was conducted by a specialist who was brought in, or allegedly conducted by a specialist brought in from Bosnia.
That's correct.
And again, could you perhaps detail for us your hypothesis as to why that would have been done?
Well, it's a good story anyway. I don't know if he was brought in from Bosnia or where. I know it took 6 weeks, so this may have been the excuse for taking so long. I think the FBI has moved very slowly in this case, because what they've attempted to do is to keep it a secret for as long as possible, hoping that the public will either lose interest or lose, you know, specific ideas or questions that they may have had. My book, Who Killed Polly, unfortunately for them, raises these questions, and I will continue to raise these questions because I feel it affects not only America's child, which is Polly Klass was called, but also a lot of America's children who, in situations that are similar to this, and they're disappearing at a tremendous rate, these little girls across the country, these things could be happening. I think that it's very important for the American people, instead of being afraid of this subject, should be awakened to it. It doesn't mean anything, I guess, until it happens to your child. But I'll tell you something. It can happen. If it can happen in a place like Petaluma, hometown America, as Ronald Reagan called it, it can happen anywhere. And this is something that all of us have to be awakened to. And what I've attempted to do is, by asking these questions, and I don't have the answers for everything, but I'll tell you something. They haven't been answered in the courtroom. And merely by having this verdict and sentencing of this man and having a judge who very flagrantly and arrogantly stated the purpose of this trial is not to educate anybody, by doing that, we are not doing justice. We are not protecting our children. And this is a sad thing in this country when we don't protect our kids.
We're going to talk about the larger implications in just a few minutes, but we should bear in mind now again, the pretrial hearing was closed to the public. What was the ostensible reason for that?
There was no reason given. The judge they even barred the family from it. Joe Klass said to me, "What are they hiding, Frank?" And that's been the case all the way along. What are they hiding? And, of course, what they were hiding in that thing was, of course, the discovery in terms of the body and the confession, which no one ever found out anything about, except what they were given finally in the end by the FBI as evidence. Everything has been covered up from day one. And it's unfortunate because we have a situation here that this little girl, I don't say Polly Klass is still alive. People have asked me, well, do you think she might still be alive? She might have been sold. What could have happened to her? Well, I do know that there's been eyewitnesses that I've spoken to that have seen American girls in brothels in Saudi Arabia with yellow doors, little girls who are 12, 13 years old, 11 years old, scanty little dresses. Men go in there 2 and 3 times their age. And these little girls, you see little girls around the back, and they're all doped up. They turn them on the street, out on the street a year or so later, they're dying of AIDS, or they just die. And I have eyewitnesses that have seen these little girls. I know that according to Nancy Spiegel, the U.S. attorney, and Bill DeWarren, who's the head of the LAPD Juvenile Division, that little girls are being murdered and tortured on videotapes and sold over Internet. This is a big business.
We're going to get into this frightening underground economy, if one could call it that, in just a couple of minutes. Now, one of the most disturbing things about the case, and that you brought out in your book, and that is the functioning of various law enforcement agencies. We've touched on the local police and their curious behavior in stopping Richard Allen Davis, who was a paroled felon, was, quote, sightseeing, unquote, on a private road after midnight while driving around drinking. This occasioned no special interest on the part of the officers. Later, despite the proliferation of composite sketches of the suspect, which looked quite a bit like Richard Allen Davis, I won't say they're identical, but there was a fair resemblance, yet CHP stopped him and arrested him for DUI, and there was no attempt to correlate that with the search for Polly Klaas. Now, you have mentioned already the strange behavior of the FBI in regard to this case. Now, from the beginning, recapping some of the things we've already touched on, there was a formidable FBI presence in connection with this case almost from the outset.
Yes.
Could you detail that for us again?
Well, the night of Polly's abduction, within 5 hours, there were 16 agents of the FBI who arrived on the scene. Then next morning, more arrived, and they took over the Petaluma Police Department, which is a small little department. They put in two huge vans with equipment in the back of the office, and by the end of the week, they had 50 FBI agents. Now, over the next 2 months, they maintained they could not come up with a clue, they could not come up with any evidence or any suspect. I asked the head of the FBI at one point, I said, you know, I don't understand. I mean, this man was out there 2 months. He fit every element of your VICAP survey.
Now, what is the VICAP survey? You touched on that earlier.
Criminal Apprehension Program. Developed by a man named Robert Rensler for the FBI. And what it is, it's primarily to find serial killers, anybody who has a violent background, because they match different things. In other words, it's they match what they know about the guy, and then they match all known felons who might relate to that kind of thing. It's pretty easy. And, of course, this fellow related to every aspect. The age was the same that he was described as. Certainly he was had kidnapped before. Twice he was convicted for kidnapping. I mean, there are various things. But the big thing is that he certainly should have been a suspect, just even living in the area. They maintain they never even, head of the FBI was funny. He said to me, well, yeah, I think it's funny, but he says, you know, well, I'm sure we'd have found him eventually. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, because, in any other case, they'd have found him in 20 minutes because he fit everything, see. But the thing is that they never, ever claimed that they ever found him until he was turned in by somebody on a tip, a person, an anonymous phone call, which has never been identified. All of this is anonymous business, and the fact a family could never see the body, and the fact that the police let the guy go because they didn't know that he was a felon, and the fact that, it just goes on and on. The APB never sent out, you know. I mean, it's just like one thing after another. And I believe there was a much darker hand involved here that put a stop each step along the way to evidence being released, to the story ever coming out.
We're going to ruminate about the possibilities of that dark hand, if not who it might have been, at least what type of executive authority might have underlay this particular crime. Going back now to the behavior of the FBI, a couple of points that I'd like you to bring out in your book. One, a noted Bay Area private investigator named Hal Lipsett was going to come in on the case, and yet he was discouraged from doing so.
Well, he wrote me a letter. He read my book, and he said, well, who killed Polly? He said, raises questions that must be answered. Hal is a very famous private investigator, and has been out of many years. He was hired by the Polly Klaas Foundation to find Polly. They paid him $5,000. And Mark Klaas and he were, the first week, were put in a room with the FBI, and the FBI said they would not cooperate with him in any way. And then they turned on Mark Klass and said, you know what's going on from the beginning. You were involved in this thing, and they demanded that Mark take a polygraph test.
That Mark Klass take a polygraph test.
Now, that's very important.
Well, why, in your opinion, was he required to take a polygraph test?
Because the FBI was stating that he was lying, that every step along the way he had been lying, that he did know what happened to Polly. You see, this was the way of them putting it on Mark.
So it is your opinion that they suspected Mark Klass of being disingenuous about his
things.
More about, we're going to attempt to discuss what might have happened here in a couple of minutes. But again, going back to the behavior of the FBI, again, the Federal Law Enforcement Agency, Barry Collins, you point out that Barry Collins, a defense attorney in this case, was he a public defender?
He's a public defender. He used to be a cab driver from Brooklyn. He's up there in Santa Rosa. He told me, he said the body was planted. I said, who planted it? He said, you find out.
Now
he never brought that out in the courtroom, you see.
All right, but he also mentioned that more than 2 years after the beginning of the case, long after Richard Allen Davis had been apprehended and confessed, the FBI was still investigating the case. Why do you think they were doing that?
What are they investigating?
Indeed. One of the things that I think looms large in this case, and I think the discrepancies in the official version of the case, the curious omissions, the curious behavior of judicial and law enforcement authorities ranging from the local police right on up to the exceedingly formidable FBI, raises a great many questions about what actually was going on. And it certainly appears quite clear, Frank, from the account that you've presented, that there was a whole lot more going on than the public was told about. Now,
And there still is.
Well, there certainly still is. Now, one of the things that is important, tying in your research with the general line of work that I engage in on this broadcast over the years, I deal with international fascism, misdeeds of the national security establishment. This type of work is often demeaned as conspiracy theory, a term that I feel is unfair. One of the stumbling points for a great many people who are not versed in this type of work, as they begin to take a look at some of the things that have taken place in the United States and elsewhere over the years, and that is a lack of credulity on their part, an unwillingness or inability to believe that institutions such as the FBI or the CIA or the military or the White House or the National Security Council could engage in some of the things that they have engaged in. There's a book about President Kennedy's assassination, for example, called Farewell America. It's by a fellow who wrote under the name of James Hepburn. It appears to have actually been released by French intelligence. It's about the assassination of President Kennedy, and they point out with regard to the FBI, or they maintain that with regard to the FBI, that in regard to President Kennedy's assassination, for example, that the special agents in the field had not only investigated, but had successfully investigated President Kennedy's assassination by the evening of 11-22-63, that they had the whole conspiracy doped out. They had it on the desk of J. Edgar Hoover by that evening, and yet, at least according to this account, it was J. Edgar Hoover who, in a sense, delivered the bureau to the conspirators. I think that,
that's your key. That's your story. See, the idea is the FBI has their own agenda. And supposedly is to protect the nation, national security. But it really has always been their own type of agenda. And a lot of what they do is based on informants. They don't investigate as much as they get information from other people. And they use this information for their own needs. One of the things that I discovered through someone I spoke with the law enforcement in Sonoma County, and this is a person that I met who's, I cannot give you his identity because I promise not to, is that this case, now this you can take for what it's worth, but Polly's abduction, he said, was a payback against Mark Klass because Mark Klass had been an FBI informant of some sort. Now, I don't know if this is true. I don't want to go any further than that necessarily, but I do know anytime I've confronted Mark Klass, he's run away from me. these questions.
Okay, now I just want to state, this is not to say that your informant is necessarily incorrect, but I want to stress for legal purposes that I have no information in that regard, and so I have to formally disclaim that, not only on my part, but on the part of the stations that will air this interview. Again, that does not necessarily mean it's incorrect, but I have no information, nor do any of the stations that air my program have any information.
Well,
in
I'm just
regard.
Using one of the, explaining one of the rumors that did go out.
Right.
Now, we're talking about what you ask why the FBI would do it, why these law enforcement agencies would do it.
There is a point. Excuse me, Frank, for interrupting, but there's a point I wanted to finish, and then I think the work that you've done here will at least head a willing investigator in the right direction. The point being, with regard to the FBI or the CIA or the military or the National Security Council, there are many, many fine men and women, honorable patriots and people of high integrity involved with these institutions. And yet, despite that, the institutions themselves will often be complicit or involved with things that are unspeakably evil. The point is that people join FBI, CIA, whatever, DIA, NSA, as a career. And the old bureaucratic and professional edict of going along to get along often obtains. One, say if you're with the FBI and I'm an employee of the federal government, you want to make it to GS whatever, or
yes,
with local law enforcement. You want to be successful in your career, and if one rocks the boat, that can often be inimical to that. Now, the point with regard to the functioning of not only the FBI, an extraordinarily powerful institution, but also local law enforcement and the courts, is that they were, as institutions, and this is not to cast aspersions on any judge, on any individual local police officer, on any individual FBI agent, but that these institutions were co-opted and corrupted by the executive authority, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
And that when one is considering the possibility of the FBI, itself an extremely powerful institution, being corrupted by whoever or whatever was the executive authority in the kidnapping of Polly Klask, it points us in the direction of some very powerful elements.
Well, children are our greatest resource in this country. They shouldn't become our greatest commodity. When you use children, I don't think anything is defensible, whether you're the FBI or whether you're a policeman or whatever. When they cover up facts, which they've done in this case, that could have led people to discovering the truth. Who hired this man? That's real important.
We're almost
That's
out of
what
time.
We've talked about all the way through this.
Indeed.
And they won't even discuss it.
Now, Frank, we're getting very low on time. I'd like to go back to a couple of points that you made earlier. You were talking about things that I've also discussed on some of my programs, things like kiddie porn, the making of snuff flicks, white slave trade, child pornography. You mentioned that among the markets, I guess one could say, for young American women or / girls, is Saudi Arabia. Could you go back to that?
Yes, well, I have eyewitnesses that have seen these little girls in these brothels with yellow doors, and it is, as I described to you, where these children are kept there, and they're, you know, that's the end of them. No one knows, and no one has done anything about it. I don't know if it's because of agreements we may have with the Saudis. I don't know if we have... what kind of agreements this country has entered into with different people around the world. I don't know what's behind all of this child pornography, but I do know that it does involve heavy-duty money, and I think that the FBI, for some reason, at least in the case of the Polly Klask situation, is withholding evidence, withholding information, and law enforcement up on the line, from what I could find out, is doing the same thing.
Now, you mentioned, too, that in addition to the Saudi Arabian market for young American girls, basically who are turned into slave prostitutes and then who, once they get too old for this sort of thing, basically are turned out into the streets to
Well,
die.
After about a year, they're dying of AIDS or something, you know. I mean, it's horrendous. A 12-year-old child is used that way.
That again from For the Record, program number 7, interview with Frank Spiring about his book, Who Killed Polly? Shortly after that interview, Frank Spiring died, and the publisher went out of business. The point being here that sexual harassment, although I do not hold a brief for that, is relatively far down on the list of violence against women and girls, and there are some real horror stories to be investigated. It appears that Polly Klaas was such a victim, and with the links between American power and Saudi Arabia, I would not expect to see these connections properly investigated. I certainly don't think that the hashtag MeToo movement is going to look into this. This concludes For the Record number 1001. Further reflections on weaponized feminism and the hashtag MeToo movement. My name is Dave Emery. This is being recorded on March 20th of 2018. Have fun.